Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. And on this week's show, we'll be talking about a whole bunch of stuff. The FBI taking down a botnet in a very FBI way, considering it's, you know, mostly not in America, so that's interesting. We'll also go deep on this Trisis malware popping up in the US following the United States' withdrawal from the so-called Iran agreement. We have a look at the latest in the crypto debate, breaches, bugs, and more. We'll also hear from Tom Uren of Australia's Strategic Policy Institute on the Trisis side of things. Tom worked in an interesting place in Australia's Defence Department, but has more recently been spending his days think tanking for ASPE. He shares his thoughts on what it is Iran could be up to with all of this Trisis stuff, and that is coming up soon. Oh, and this week's show is brought to you by Australia. AustCyber is a government-supported industry group here in Australia that is trying to get the Australian cybersecurity industry organised. There's the VC-backed US model, the Israel model of, hey, let's build an entire cyber city, and then there's the Australia model, which is actually quite different. It's much more about helping local startups win deals locally than internationally to get them on a path to profitability so they don't have to sign awful term sheets offered by Australian VCs. Well, there's a fair bit more to it than just that, but AustCyber head honcho Michelle Price will be along in this week's sponsor interview to walk us through what she's trying to do for the Australian security industry and how foreign multinational companies may also benefit from that. But before all of that, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, it's a pretty light news week this week, mostly because it was the Memorial Day weekend in the United States. That's just been and gone. So yeah, a little bit light on news this week. But, you know, of course, everyone's flapping their arms because the Russians are in the routers. This so-called VPN filter malware affecting something like 500,000 routers has been generating headlines quite a lot of headlines.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting story for a couple of reasons. I mean, obviously the big one is that it's a botnet attributed directly to, a nation state operator for the purpose of, you know, bouncing your connectivity through, a pool of machines that you can use to obfuscate who it is and what it's doing. And obviously coming off people's home network connections, with this botnet targets primarily, you know, kind of small office and home routers and network equipment and NAS devices and things. You know, the sorts of things we've seen co-opted in the past for denial of service, but in this case has been co-opted to do anything you want, but as a proxy network, as a tool for, you know, rummaging around inside people's networks and other things like that. And that, you know, being attributed to a nation state, I guess, is interesting. It's also been talked up as though it was like super technically advanced, which, you know, like one article I read had an example of how advanced it was in that it could do persistence by adding a cron job, you know, like, so super.
Well, I mean, you know, to really impress us, it'd need to do persistence via systemd, right? I mean, anyone who can make that work, I mean, hey.
Yeah, they can probably write a systemd unit file. It's an interesting story from that angle. I mean, the botnet itself, 500,000 boxes obviously is quite a lot. We haven't really seen something like this attributed directly to a nation state before. I mean, obviously some people are going to say, well, you know, what about Conficker? And we don't really know the story behind Conficker yet. So, I mean, there are other examples of it. And of course, it's a natural. Like, if you were a nation state and you wanted to go about your business without, you know, having to worry about it being attributed to you, then, you know, 500,000 home user boxes is a perfect place to hide it. So, I mean, oh, great, it makes
sense. Great bunch of devices for DDoSing as well.
Yeah, I mean, and of course, DDoSing is a thing that, the Russians have used, right? And plenty of people, have used. But, I mean, one particular, the story is broken in a couple of segments. Like, one was Cisco Talos had been monitoring the command and control and saw a separate command and control being set up for devices in Ukraine with a big uptick in the number of infections right before, you know, I think it was a big soccer match or something coming up. And there was some suggestion that it was going to be part of an actual, you know, either a DOS or some other kind of, you know, like brick all the devices at once attack. In Ukraine. So there's that angle to it. And then, of course, the other thing is that the FBI managed to get a court order to take over the command and control and sinkhole it themselves.
And it's interesting because once this thing, you know, once you're infected with this thing, I mean, it persists in that it goes out to that domain to grab the payload to run it. But if you reboot it, if you reboot the device and that domain isn't there, it can't get its payload. So now, basically, the FBI's put out a statement saying everyone should reboot these routers, which means it'll still be going out to the domain, but trust us, it's the FBI and we totally won't payload your device.
Pretty much. And obviously some people are a little bit upset about that, I guess.
Well, it's funny considering that most of the devices, like hardly any of them are in America, but it would seem to be good advice to go give them a reboot and just hope that the FBI has actually blackholed it and they're not waiting for certain IP ranges to, you know, to serve another. Yeah, anyway.
Well, I mean, given that your choices are the FBI not running, you know, not serving second stage payloads, or you have the Russian GRU in your home router actually running payloads, take your pick, right?
Well, that's it. Who do you want to be? Do you want to be definitely owned by the Russians or maybe owned by the Americans? Comes down to. But yeah, look, as I say, it's been getting an absolute ton of attention. And, you know, there is the Ukraine angle. There's also the FBI blackholing it angle. There's the backlash angle, which is people saying this is dumb of the FBI to be making noise about this, considering it barely affects any American hosts. But all in all, I got to say, I think it looks reasonably well handled, actually. And the FBI has probably done a good job here.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. The fact that they've managed to take down a major piece of infrastructure, you know, is really good. You know, it wasn't that long ago that anyone taking down any botnet was big news, you know, let alone one operated by, you know, state-sponsored attackers, you know, specifically for doing, you know, kind of nasty things at a geopolitical level. Like, that's pretty big news. So, yeah. The one further thing I did want to mention about it is that there was some of that, one of the attribution tells that was interesting is, and then Cisco Talos wrote this up, in the first stage loader, there's some crypto code that uses an RC implementation of RC4 to crypto some comms and stuff. And it's actually a buggy in a quite a specific way that is common with another piece of malware that was used to attack critical infrastructure in Ukraine, the Sandworm crew, which is also attributed to GRU, but some people say is a different group within the GRU than the Fancy Bear. But anyway, the fact that there is code sharing, a particular buggy piece of code between this and another piece of malware from from the Russians that's been used in Ukraine, I think is an interesting, sort of a little interesting side note.
Yeah, and I mean, we would point out, though, that, you know, making attribution just based on code similarity isn't generally the done thing, but the noise on this one is loud enough for me to be convinced that, there is some evidence there. Now, speaking of state-backed activity, the so-called Trisys malware, and this is the stuff that we've spoken about on the show quite a few times, this is the stuff that popped up in Saudi Arabia and was designed to, you know, make an industrial control facility go bang and didn't work because it was buggy. Well, that stuff has started popping up in the United States. And this is something we've been tracking pretty closely, Adam, because, you know, we thought, hey, maybe Iran's going to go after Trump's personal interests because that's an easy way to sort of get some payback on him in a way that won't result in a kinetic response. But I said at the time that I'd be very surprised if they started directly attacking American control systems and making them go bang, but it certainly looks like they're doing the groundwork right now.
Yeah, no, the story is that particular, you know, set of tools and malware is starting to show up around the US, and the suggestion, of course, is that it's what the Americans call preparing the battle space, where you own a bunch of stuff in advance and get all your things in place. And of course, in the case of industrial control systems, you do need if you want to make things blow up, you do have to do a whole bunch of work. I mean, it's not like you can just press a button and have a control system, you know, magically make a plant explode. You do have to understand the specific plant and the specific industrial processes and the specific fail safes and other controls and monitoring and that kind of thing. So there's quite a lot involved in that. So it makes sense to go into these facilities in advance, read the current configuration, understand what they're doing, and then if you need your payloads later on, you've got them on the shelf rather than having to, you know, kind of make them in a hurry and balls it up. So,
Well, look, speaking of that, I had a good chat to one of the policy people at ASPI, the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. He's a DOD guy at ASPI and Australian DOD. And, you know, I wanted to know really from someone in that world, like whether or not we would be talking out of our hats if we were to say that this is designed as deterrence. And Tom Uren joined me by phone to give me his thoughts. And he says this is very much signaling. Here he is.
I think it's signaling. I think I'd be extremely surprised if the Iranians actually did anything. And when I say do anything, I mean actually cause some kind of physical damage or attack. Just because that would be so escalatory, and the US has any number of conventional military responses that would be just really bad, and I don't think anyone really wants to go there. So I think they're trying to like you say, signal.
Well, I mean, it strikes me that this is a form of deterrence. This is a way of saying, you know, hey, if you start dropping bombs on Tehran, steel mills in Ohio could start going bang. I mean, is that possible that there's intended as a type of deterrent?
I think Iran's been really interesting in that they've used cyber means to retaliate and for all sorts of things in the past. So they've US financial sector DDoS attacks, but also Las Vegas Sands casino. So they've indicated a real willingness to, in sort of relative terms, go all out using destructive attacks. I think that's got to be in the back of anyone's mind. So, yeah, I think that's highly likely that's in their thought process.
Although, I mean, it should be pointed out, and this is something you pointed out to me earlier during an earlier phone conversation, there is a bit of a flaw in considering this as a reliable deterrent. Could you explain to the listeners what that is? Because it's something that I'm ashamed to say just did not occur to me.
I think Iran is trying to use it as a deterrent, but it's not clear to me that it's a viable one because the US has a lot of information about Iranian hacking groups, and we don't know if NSA isn't already in Iran looking at what these blokes are doing.
Well, you'd think that the crew behind Trisis at this point are pretty much public enemy number one on the internet as far as, you know, Fort Meade's concerned. You would hope so.
Yeah, so there's definitely a very strong motivation. NSA's got every reason to be trying to get into these groups, whether they've been successful or not, who knows.
Hmm. Now, one other thing that you did point out to me is that Trisis isn't some sort of, generic malware that can just be, deployed to any control system and then used to make things go bang. There's quite a lot of customization work that goes into this, which tends to support the idea that this is signaling. That's from your own research into this. I mean, it looks like that's the case, isn't it? That this isn't just some sort of, highly generic ICS thing. It does need to be tailored, and that requires substantial hours and information.
Certainly, if you're trying for something destructive, you really need to know what you're working with and how you can manipulate the ICS infrastructure to get that destructive effect. I mean, it's not as if industrial control systems have an explode command. So to get the effect you want, you need to do a lot of homework. And depending upon how keen you are on just blowing everything up, you need to make sure that what you're doing doesn't have further unintended consequences. So I think when you're talking about US critical infrastructure, at least I wouldn't be deploying willy-nilly and running wild. I'd make sure that I knew what I was doing. And that takes time and effort and more than a few days or a few months, I think.
A few weeks back on the show, we actually sort of floated the idea that one viable option for Iran to cause some harm to the executive branch of the United States was to target the president directly or target his business interests because, criminal attacks against his interests are unlikely to lead to some sort of, kinetic response, right? Do you think that is on the agenda here? Do you think that's something that could realistically happen?
I think that's actually the most sensible response from Iran. I think partly because Trump has really closely associated himself with the pullout from the nuclear deal and the resumption of sanctions. I think it's not escalatory from a nation state point of view. So, any response where Trump says that we need to escalate just doesn't make sense for the US establishment. And I also think the Trump organization is likely to be a much softer target than some of the ICS infrastructure where at least you've got DHS and FBI trying to look out for what's going on. So that actually makes total sense to me.
Well, I did have some people throwing a bit of shit at me for appearing to endorse a certain course of action that Iran could take, but I'm glad, Tom, that you have also encouraged Iran to attack Trump interests. just kidding. I know what you're saying. This is a likely scenario. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Patrick.
Tom Uren there, big thanks to him for that. And I guess one of the most interesting things I think he said there is that really as a deterrent, you're never going to know how effective it's going to be because for all we know, the NSA is all up in the Trisis crew's shit. You know what I mean? They are probably all up in their shit right now.
Well, I mean, that's kind of their mandate, right? I mean, if they're not, then what are you doing? And yeah, that's the you know, I guess in the nuclear era, in the Cold War era, and within the concept of you know, kind of deterrence and mutually assured destruction, like the fact that it was assured is one of the key bits of that acronym, and that's the problem with using cyber as a deterrent, is everything's so murky, and who knows what's actually going to happen, you know, on the day when you, you know, when you run the script, whether it's going to work or not, or whether there's somebody else in your scripts trace bustering your trace buster.
And, exactly.
And yeah.
And I mean, if Iran knew that the NSA was in that stuff, well, they would kick them out, right? So the fact is, Iran has to know that whether or not the US has infiltrated that particular crew is a known unknown.
Yeah, it does. It gets all very Rumsfeldian, doesn't it?
It does.
which is the problem. So relying on it as a deterrence thing, right? I mean, it's probably a good idea. I mean, as you said, like, I mean, this is a smart play for Iran, and it's the natural.
Well, it's posturing and signaling rather than a reliable deterrent. I think that's where we've landed on this.
Yes, yeah, no, and I agree. I think that is a sensible analysis.
Now, turning our attention to the FBI telling bold-faced fibs about going dark. You know, this is just, the coverage here just doesn't look good. And, you know, I mean, regular listeners would know that I'm actually quite sympathetic towards law enforcement agencies all over the world who are having a pretty tough time of it, actually trying to get certain types of content off seized devices in very serious criminal matters. But it doesn't help people like me who are a little bit sympathetic when they go around telling porkies like these ones, Adam.
Yeah, no, it turns out that the numbers that the FBI were quoting of devices that they had in custody, which they couldn't get into, which they were saying, I think in 2017, it was something like 7,000 devices that they couldn't have access to, which compared with, what was it, 800 the year before. You know, a few people were, I suppose, were skeptical of those numbers. Anyway, a report from the Department of Justice Inspector General into this actually turns out that they had not quite got their numbers right. It appears that they had a number of databases storing details about which particular devices they had, and I guess some of the specifics got a little bit lost in communication, and yeah, the number is quite a lot less, perhaps about 1,000 rather than 7,000, because they'd counted a bunch of the devices more than once, or indeed 7 or 8 times by how the numbers have lined up. So yeah, not really helping their cause at all, and unfortunately they look like plonkers as a result.
Yeah, and they never should have used numbers to try to sell this, right? They should have used case studies. And for a while they were shopping one around about some poor teenage girl who was murdered, and, you know, investigators couldn't get into her phone to sort of find out who she'd been messaging, and, you know, that would have given them a real advantage in solving that case. And case studies like that, it's my feeling that they're more powerful. Pick 10 really solid ones and talk about them, not numbers in a spreadsheet. That's how you can actually begin to make your case for this.
Risky Business PR services available for hire. I mean, the FBI would like to talk to Pat.
You hear what I mean, right?
Like, yeah, no,
because,
of course, no,
because
right.
The problem is there's so many people, like a lot of the people, I feel like a lot of the people who are very anti-LA access are people who've lived quite privileged lives and have never had their lives touched by crime, right? And that's just something that I've noticed is the more likely you are to have actually experienced crime impacting on you throughout your life, the more likely you are to kind of see maybe that law enforcement aren't always about trying to surveil you because you wrote a controversial blog post. It's you know, most of the time they're investigating very serious crimes, and some of the people who are going free and some of the crimes that are unsolved because of this situation are quite serious. And I think that's where we got to have the conversation. And I'm not saying go for the ones that are going to pull the heartstrings. I'm saying just really try to paint an accurate picture of what's happening without just numbers on a spreadsheet. They don't tell a story.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, it's a much more nuanced and complicated debate than just, oh, look, here's a bunch of numbers, right? It does need to be, you know, because it kind of goes right to the root of, you know, what's the obligation of the state to protect the people, and what's the obligation of the people to disclose some, you know, to give up some privacy or some rights to the state. For, you know, it's a much more complicated debate than just numbers. And
yeah.
I think you're right.
Now, Krebs has a really good story. Of course, there's been all this news over the last few weeks about police in America being able to get unfettered access, real-time access to people's locations via their cell phones, via these like third-party marketing services, which just seems to me a pretty dumb idea for that situation to continue. But Krebs has got a nice little feature he's put together about how we got here.
Yeah, now Krebs has done a two-part series, you know, talking about a bunch of the issues that have led up to the situation, and in particular sort of the relationship between privacy rules for service providers, the net neutrality debate, and sort of who's responsible for having effective oversight of carriers and telcos and operators, mobile opcos in the US. And yeah, it's quite a good write-up of, I guess as an outsider, not really understanding all of the domestic situation there. It is quite a good summary of how they ended up where they are, although it's still not really clear to me how, like, why this is okay, like that the carriers can, are just selling location information wholesale to third parties.
Yeah, no, I don't get that either. And it's there are a few of these things like that just sort of happen, right? The other one is license plate scanners that are mounted into cop cars. Like, what happens to that data? You ask people, no one can tell you. And I just sort of get the feeling that, occasionally we really do get the sense that the law is very much behind the reality. And this is a perfect example.
Yeah, no, it really is, right? And the telcos, even if you, and Krebs has asked, I think, some of them, what the situation is, and they ended up just kind of like waffling and pointing to the privacy policy. And I actually went and read my mobile operator's privacy policy this afternoon after I read this piece to try and say, well, in New Zealand, does my mobile operator give my location data to, marketing agencies? And
you don't know.
Sure. I don't know. Like, yeah. I think it says it doesn't, but maybe it does. I mean, it's really not at all. I mean, I can't tell, right? So who knows? Here I am throwing stones at the Americans.
I laughed at Joe Cox in Vegas because he lives on an iPod Touch and doesn't have a phone. And oh, how I laughed at him. And yeah. Okay, guy, you might have a point. But anyway, yeah. great feature from CyberScoop here on what Cyber Command got up to in its operations against Islamic State. Much of what you would expect, but there's a really great little case study here where they essentially shamooned a ISIS command post, which forced them, like, just bricked all of their computers, which forced them out into their alternate command posts, and they could track them there and then hit all of their command posts. And I just thought, interesting use of wiper malware.
Yeah, no, it is. It's a really interesting kind of little case study. And the
I know that this case study results in a whole bunch of people being blown up, but that's the best thing about ISIS. You can just be like, I don't care. That's great. Those guys got exploded.
Grim. The story was reported actually originally on military.com based on a talk given at a conference somewhere, a military conference somewhere. They were surveilling the command post, with drones and whatever else, and they were planning on raiding it, but they didn't know where all the alternates were. And so, yeah, as you say, they took out through cyber means all of the comms and computers in there, forcing the people there to disperse to their alternates whilst they were being watched from above. And then they hit all of the alternate sites as well in one go. And it was sort of, that seems like a pretty smart operation. Yeah. And as a, as a combined arms thing, using, orbital observation or, drone observation plus cyber plus actual kinetic techniques is kind of interesting. The thing I took away from it, though, was that they did seem frustrated, the military that were involved in doing this operation, at quite how long it took to get the cyber ducks in a row, versus let's just, lob a tomahawk at something, job done. Like that, that
20 minutes versus a couple of weeks, trying to find the right lure on the right device to then pivot.
Yeah,
you need patience, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it does kind of illustrate that, that all of the fears of cyber war, that it isn't quite as immediate and straightforward as some of the other avenues you've got available to you. And that's an important thing that they learned from that, that you do have to, be well prepared. And maybe it isn't quite as flexible as, some people pushing it as a doctrine would imagine.
Yeah, but I mean, you often hear people talk about so-called cyber war, and it's not, in my mind, it's not really a thing. It is just something you use with other things for different sorts of effects. And, this is just it's a very interesting case study, much like some of the cell phone tracking stuff they were doing for targeting and whatnot, Oh, my commander has told me to meet him in this open field. I will get there post haste. Next up, Red's in the blockchain.
Yes. Oh, no. No, apparently some Chinese researchers from Kihu 360s, a very good research team, have been looking into blockchains, and I offer my condolences. I'm sorry that we've pushed such terrible, capitalist technologies upon you. Anyway, they've been looking at this new Ethereum-like blockchain called EOS. Similar sort of smart contract rubbish. Anyway, they found some bugs that let you own nodes in it, and the people who are running this particular blockchain, which hasn't quite launched yet, are saying that it's all kind of FUD and they totally patched it and it didn't matter, and I don't know. Anyway, I wouldn't put my money in it, but...
Yeah, Chihu 360 have a track record of kind of being right about bad things,
well,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
So, I know... I know where I'm putting my faith, let's put it that way, and it's not in the blockchain people, surprisingly enough. Oracle is dropping Java serialization support. Now, this one sort of struck me. That's kind of big news. I mean, they're just moving it out of the core of the products and sort of putting it in these modules, which I'm sure are just even worse than having it in the core products. But tell us what this all means, Adam.
So, Mark Reinhold, who's the chief architect of the Java platform at Oracle, was giving an interview, and he said that they are thinking about, are planning to remove serialization support from the core language, and that adding it, 30 years ago, whatever it is now, was a bad idea, which, he's right, it was a bad idea. Actually removing it from the core language, the thing is, there's no roadmap for actually doing that, right? They're not sure when, it's just...
Well, and a lot of people are using it. This is the thing that occurred to me.
That's the other...
All this is going to do is ensure people are using ancient Java. Yay!
Well, yeah, I mean, if they just ripped it out right now, then people just wouldn't apply patches because loads of stuff wouldn't work. And there's plenty of places where serialization is used in Java or in any programming language, where it doesn't cross a security boundary, where it's not relevant from a security perspective, and all those cases are still going to be there and still need support for such a thing. And, I can see from Oracle's point of view, it would be great to say, okay, 40% of our security patches are fixing goddamn serialization bugs. If we throw serialization out of the core library, make it an open source project, it's the community's problem, we can fire 35% of our Java devs, think of all of the bonuses we'll make for saving money, won't it be wonderful? Right, I can see that line of reasoning, but it isn't going to make the need for serialization type functionality go away, and all we're going to see is that Java devs will use, five different frameworks for doing it instead of,
they're either going to use ancient Java or like really shitty implementations of serialization that are worse than what they had previously. So even basically worse. This is only a good strategy if Oracle also has a time machine. So they can retrospectively remove it, go back 30 years, reverse that decision, then come back.
Yes, that might be a functional thing, but I would much rather that they kept it in the core language and made it difficult to use haphazardly rather than bung it out and then say, well, you're on your own tough.
But that sounds hard.
It does. It does sound hard. Although, there is a serialization filter, the serialization filtering support in the language, although obviously in relatively recent Java runtimes, and most people aren't running those anyway. So, obviously it is hard to do it right, and it's easier to bung it out, throw it over your shoulder and forget about it, which I don't know. Who knows? Oracle might throw the whole Java out. Who knows what's going to happen?
Mate, that's actually it for the week's news. Thank you very much for joining us. That was all good. And we'll chat to you again next week.
Yeah, cheers, Pat. We'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Bialow there with a look at the week's news, which also featured a brief appearance from Tom Uren of Aspie. Big thanks to him for that. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Michelle Price of OstCyber. OstCyber was established as part of the Australian Government's Industry Growth Centres Initiative and was announced as part of the Government's National Innovation and Science Agenda and Australia's Cybersecurity Strategy. Michelle Price was the first senior advisor for cybersecurity at the National Security College within the Australian National University. And prior to that, Michelle basically wrote the Australian Government's 2015 Cybersecurity Review and Cybersecurity Strategy. So, OstCyber basically exists to support the local security industry. Not just to support it, actually, but to grow it and to turn it into a real industry. And it makes sense. If you throw a rock at any Silicon Valley security team, you've got a pretty good chance of hitting an Aussie who's moved over there. And if you look at things like statistics from BugCrowd, by country, you'll find that on a population normalized basis, Australians are massively overrepresented. I think we produce the, largest number of bugs per head of population of any country in the world. And sure, I know that's just one measure, but everywhere you look here, you see good ideas, smart ideas and serious talent. So why don't we have a thriving cybersecurity sector along the lines of Israel's? Well, Michelle Price heads OstCyber and wants to get Australia's security industry moving. How will she do that? She joined me to tell me what she has in mind. Here she is.
In the simplest terms possible, our goal is to grow a vertical by switching on a horizontal.
Oh, that's catchy. That's catchy. Although my bullshitometer might have peaked out a little bit there. What does that mean?
That means that by supporting Australian cybersecurity startups and scale-ups, to not only grow their capability from home in terms of being able to respond to growing domestic, demand. So that's where the horizontal comes into it, switching on every sector of the Australian economy to be able to understand why cybersecurity is so important to the resilience of their business, not just tomorrow, but today as well. It's also positioning our sector to be one that is very export-oriented. So while we do recognise that there is a growing demand domestically and that actually is going to have a long tail in it, because we know that Australians traditionally are a little bit lazy around figuring out that this thing called digital has happened, that actually there is a huge demand for Australian cybersecurity solutions overseas. And so we want them to be able to grow at home and export to the world.
Yeah. Now I'm somewhat familiar. I've worked with AusCyber now for a little while, and I'm sort of familiar with the model here. And quite often it might be you take some people who are developing some good technology, and you might help them get in with some local institutions, whether that's government or finance or something, so that they've got some money coming in the door, and that just sort of helps them build their tech. And then it's a matter of doing the road shows and, you know, taking some of these companies to RSA, putting them on my podcast in the sponsored segments, for example. So that's the idea here, is really to stimulate the local sector. But I got to ask, right, one bottleneck that people often talk to me about when it comes to starting a cybersecurity company in Australia is they go and try to get venture capital. It's very, very difficult. And usually when they do get an offer, the term sheets are absolutely horrible. And that's what drives people like Casey Ellis to California. So, I mean, is that something that AusCyber is working on? And is it something that AusCyber is able to work on?
Yes and yes. So we're actually spending quite a bit of our time right now developing deep relationships with various VCs in Australia. And this is part of our approach to developing what we're calling end-to-end incubation and acceleration infrastructure. But infrastructure in a way that perhaps hasn't been done for other tech-related sectors in the economy before now, where we actually see it as more of a circular relationship between an idea, so ideation in the sort of, I guess, innovation nation kind of language, but right through to how you exit at home as well as abroad, and be able to come back in and do it again and keep that sort of chain of events happening such that we can develop that export capability as a nation. So the VCs obviously do have a really, really important part to play in all of that. And what we're doing is not only educating local VCs around what the opportunity is in Australia, that actually there is, first of all, opportunity in Australia, but what the breadth and depth of that opportunity actually is. And of course, some of that starts with actually educating the VCs around why they themselves need cybersecurity in their businesses, and to prove what's at risk here if we don't get this equation right, not only in terms of being able to, invest in cybersecurity companies themselves, but also for them to be looking out for whether or not other companies that they might be engaging with have cyber resiliency in their business models. So it's a kind of a double play there, I guess, in some regards. But also as part of that, it's looking at what kind of global relationship we can have in the exchange of capital around the cybers. Because, of course, the cybers are not just geographically situated, they're situated all over the place. And so in encouraging Australian companies to stay at home and not pick up and go overseas like folks have in the past, such as Casey and others, that actually you can have connection through to capital wherever you might need it. And this is part of why we do the road shows, not only from a showcasing perspective, but also to do it from that relationship management perspective and developing trusted partnerships. So yes, we can do that as part of our remit, and we're focused pretty strongly on it at the moment. And people will be seeing more and more of this coming through our public communications over the next 6 to 12 months.
Yeah, well, and I guess having this sort of, you know, government-backed organization doing this sort of stuff might make investments more appealing, especially once you can demonstrate, you know, some success in driving business for these Australian companies. But, you know, it occurs to me that, you know, the global infosec scene, you know, if you're going to make the comparison, it's almost like, you know, how there's all those Australian actors in Hollywood. You know, I sort of feel like cybersecurity is a little bit the same way. You know, you go to Black Hat, and then there's all those people who've just gradually sort of moved over there because we don't have the opportunities of the size that some of our most talented people want, right? It's the same reason that, you know, your Hugh Jackmans and Nicole Kidmans go off to America, is to chase that opportunity. You know, I guess part of the goal here is to keep those people at home, right?
It is. And so part of that is not only being able to, I guess, prove to those companies that we do have the ability to be able to do it from Australia, because, of course, the greatest opportunity that cyber does offer us is that you don't necessarily physically have to be all things to all people and be everywhere to do it, that, you know, you have to split your time between lots of different locations. The other side of that equation is that, of course, we're in an environment where trust is actually our currency, as much as there's lots of other currencies available to us. Trust is our currency. And of course, what we have discovered very, very quickly is that that trust is pretty strong in Australian capability. And so to be able to demonstrate to others outside of Australia that actually that's what they're engaging with every day, that almost every time you come across a truly innovative solution, particularly in the US, there's usually an Australian behind it, or at least a team of Australians that have been involved in it. So it's proving to Australians, as well as to those overseas, that you can actually do it from home, and that doesn't change the way that you do business. What it does do is actually open up further opportunities for collaboration and partnership. And some of the greatest successes that we're seeing so far is when the cybers do actually partner with each other to deliver a more dynamic solution than what's otherwise available.
So I guess, you know, the pitch here is, and I like it how you say every time there's a good idea, there's usually an Australian behind it. I'm not sure quite that I can let that one slide. You know, I risk offending Risky Business's considerable offshore audience there, Michelle. But I guess also, you know, the role, the goal here is also to promote the use of Australian technology in the export markets. And, you know, one country that's had a lot of success doing that is Israel. And you've been looking quite closely at the Israel model. I mean, how did the Israeli government help its local sector convince the world to buy its tech?
It's a really good question, and it's one that it would not surprise you that we get asked all the time. So the government in Israel, looking at what kind of capability it had within its military environment and looking at the opportunities in a massively and rapidly growing international market for cybersecurity solutions, clearly identified that if they started to spin out some of the technologies that they were using within their military that didn't, of course, impact their ability to defend themselves in their part of the world, could actually make them some money, both in terms of growing their economy, because their economy is a very small, like tiny, tiny economy, but also to be able to start, I guess, developing a narrative for Israel that went beyond the military. And one great way to do this was to take advantage of the fact that they had an appeal and could chase demand that was very real.
And I guess we're trying to change the narrative from iron ore and nice beaches. You know, the old joke about Australia's economy is that it's, you know, Japan's beach and China's quarry. I mean, it would be nice to get past that.
Absolutely, absolutely. And Israel has struggled with this in its own way. And so I think with the Israeli model, what we can see is that there's been success that's come from that really solid and consistent and reliable investment from government in the establishment of its sector. And, you know, Be'er Sheva in the desert is well known around the world through CyberSpark as being sort of, you know, the cyber industry that fell from a sky. You know, it sort of sprung up overnight. And that's actually how it was able to do that. Was to invest a pretty serious amount of money in a reasonably transparent way to set up that sector. The bubble might burst at some point, and this is what we're seeing, is that, you know, you can only have so many flowers bloom in the startup space before you realise that actually the longevity and the sustainability of what comes back at you in terms of your return on that investment as a government is that you do actually have to have scale-ups at some point. And this is where we know we've actually got a market difference to the Israelis, is that we do have scale-ups who are staying at home in Australia because there are opportunities here as well as abroad.
Can you name some of them?
In terms of our scale-ups?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got organisations like Senatas, like Cogito, you know, Haven Tech, even... You know, if we consider actually some of the audience of Risky Business know of Deception AI and Pen10 now, they over the past 6 months have grown from being an organisation of around about 12 people to pretty close to 45 now. And in the Australian context, that's a scale up.
Even in the United States, that's definitely larger than a lot of early stage startups, right? That's not to be sneezed at. That's a lot of people. It's a lot of bums on seats.
Yeah. it is a lot of bums on seats. And we're seeing that there is a cluster of companies who are at that phase right now. Some of them have done it through VC assistance, but lots of them haven't. And this is partly because they're wanting to make sure that they really do have a market opportunity to be able to continue a sustained scale-up environment.
It did occur to me that the AustCyber model is almost about trying to help people. Because the VC scene here is so horrible, it does seem almost like what you're trying to do is help people bootstrap by connecting, you know, buyers with new technology. I mean, is that a gross oversimplification, or is it close?
It's pretty close. That is actually pretty close. I mean, the Rolodex that we have between me and the team is a pretty deep one. And again, it comes back to that trust that, you know, if we've done the vetting of the companies and can see the market opportunities, whether they be in the small business market of, say, retail or defence industry, or, you know, pick a sector in the economy where we can do those proofs of concept and then, you know, use that Rolodex to then take the next step and then the next step and then the next step after that, and that we wear the risk on that as an organisation that's backed by government. We think that's a more sustainable way to grow a sector than perhaps what Israel and others have done.
Which is just pumping absolute tons of money into it and hoping for returns down the track. I mean, this does seem a little more strategic, right?
That's right. And, you know, I mean, Israel will play their game the way that they see fit for their circumstances. But certainly from our position in the world and where we see MNCs choosing Australia deliberately because of our talent and because of our ability to offer them to follow the sun when it comes to cybersecurity operations.
Well, that's what I was going to ask too. This is my next line of questioning. Sorry to cut you off, but, you know, we have limited time. And I just wanted to ask if part of the role of AustCyber is to encourage you know, foreign entities, like, you know, particularly like American and European sort of, you know, cybersecurity concerns, to invest in teams here. Is that the sort of investment we want, or do we want to own our presence in the sector?
So this is where we do say that, of course, yes, we do work with overseas companies and we do choose our partners wisely. But that's what we say, is that we actually want it to be a partnership. So where companies are wanting to come into Australia to leverage our follow the sun ability, or to buy local capability, or to even actually just invest in the R&D space because of, you know, that deep tech opportunity that we do have, which is something that is hugely under-celebrated in my view, is that, yes, we look to do that in a partnership arrangement. So if an MNC is wanting to come in and develop some kind of a team, we actually say do that with local capability, because not only will that afford you to start up and scale up much quicker in the local market, you'll actually get credibility in the market, which, you know, we know that Australians are pretty sceptical and cynical of outsiders. You know, you can get legitimacy a lot quicker if you're actually partnering with existing local entities, because we do that, I guess, relationship vetting pretty quickly. We'll judge you, and we'll see whether or not you're the real deal. And, you know, are you going to be here longer than 5 minutes or are you going to go elsewhere in Asia? So, you know, I think that's certainly the approach that we prefer to take, and that's working pretty well so far.
Now, I know from personal experience how busy you are at the moment, and I can sort of see why, because, you know, this is a promotional segment for AustCyber, and it sounds like what you're trying to do right now is you're trying to hear from venture capital funds, you're trying to hear from foreign multinationals who might be interested in perhaps developing some technology here. You're interested in hearing from local startups. You're interested in hearing from local buyers, right? I mean, these are all people that you're dealing with, right? So this is the call out here on Risky Business, Michelle. You want all of those people to contact you, right?
Absolutely do. And,
yeah. No wonder you're
and
busy.
Everyone else. That's right. No, we actually sort of say, you know, we've got our external hashtag, which is game on. You know, you can look at all of the different ways that hashtag is used, but we use it to say, look, we're in business here. And our internal hashtag is all the things. We are all the things. We've been accused previously of boiling the ocean. We love that, because actually when you're starting a sector from scratch, when there's been great capability leave this country for no good reason other than we haven't had our eyes on the prize, it absolutely needs to be, every button needs to be pressed. So yeah, look me up and we will make sure that we respond to whatever you want to do to help us out in this endeavour, because we think that we're onto something here, and I want to make sure that in a generation's time, we look back on this moment and know that we really did seize the opportunity, because it's there for the taking.
Michelle Price, that's a perfect place to end it. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Michelle Price of OstCyber there. And you know how you're hearing an Australian vendor or startup in every edition of Snake Oilers? Yep, that's OstCyber behind that. And I really, really hope that they can help us locals get our shit together, because that would be quite nice. We have been punching below our weight in terms of industry while punching above our weight in terms of talent. And, you know, it's certainly a situation I hope Michelle can change. Okay, so it's song time now. And talk about a polarizing thing. When I stopped doing music at the end of the show some time back, some people were really upset and some people were thrilled because they didn't like my taste in music. But I'm playing one this week because it's a great example of how you can take a sugar-coated pop song, play it with real instruments, and make it work. This is a Brazilian artist, Zeca Baleiro, with his version of Price Tag by Jesse J. I do hope you enjoy it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
Seems like everybody's got a price. I wonder how they sleep at night. When they say it comes first and the truth comes second, just stop for a minute and smile. Why is everybody so serious? Acting so damn mysterious. There are shades on your eyes, on your heels so high that you can't even have a good time. Everybody looks to their left, everybody looks to their right. Can you feel that? Yeah, we're paying them in love tonight. It's not about money, money, money. We don't need your money, money, money. We just wanna make the world dance. Forget about the price tag. Get about the cha-ching, cha-ching, get about the yeah, bubbling, bubbling, wanna make the world dance. Forget about the price, yeah. We need to take it back in time, when music made us all unite. And it wasn't low blows and video hoes. Am I the only one getting tired? Why is everybody so obsessed? Money can't buy us happiness. Can we all slow down and enjoy it right now? Guarantee we'll be feeling alright. Everybody looks to their left, everybody looks to their right. Can you feel that? Yeah, we're paying them in love tonight. It's not about money, money, money. We don't need your money, money, money. We just wanna make the world dance. Forget about the price tag. And about the cha-ching, cha-ching, and about the yeah, bubbling, bubbling. Wanna make the world dance. Forget about the price tag. Need your money, money, money. We just wanna make the world dance. Forget about the price tag. Get about the ha, cha-ching, cha-ching. Get about the yeah, bubbling, bubbling. Wanna make the world dance. Forget about the price tag. It's not about the money, money, money. We don't need your money, money, money. We just wanna make the world dance. Forget about the price tag. Cha-ching, cha-ching, get about the...